Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. In our badly fractured society, can public servants and politicians act with decency and argue about policy with restraint and dignity? I believe the answer is yes, and so I invited a man on the show who epitomizes such virtues to talk about his varied career and the importance of the nation's founding principles. Dr. Benjamin S. Carson, Sr., M.D., was born in Detroit to a single mother with a third-grade education, who raised her son to love reading and learning. He graduated from Yale University and earned his MD from the University of Michigan Medical School. For nearly 30 years, Dr. Carson served as director of pediatric neurosurgery at the Johns Hopkins Children's Center, a position he assumed when he was just 33 years old, becoming the youngest major division director in the hospital's history. In 1987, he successfully performed the first separation of craniopagus twins conjoined at the back of the head. In 2016, Dr. Carson was a presidential candidate and later served as the 17th Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the first Trump administration. His newest endeavor is as founder and chairman of the American Cornerstone Institute, a new organization whose stated mission is to promote the four founding principles which are the cornerstones of our country, faith, liberty, community, and life, as well as pursue common sense solutions that challenge conventional groupthink. Dr. Carson has received dozens of honors and awards in recognition of his achievements, including the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. Dr. Carson and his wife, Candy Carson, co-founded the Carson Scholars Fund, which recognizes young people of all backgrounds for exceptional academic and humanitarian accomplishments. He has authored several books, five of which were co-authored with Candy, including The Perilous Fight, Overcoming Our Culture's War on the American Family. The couple are the proud parents of three adult sons and many grandchildren. Dr. Carson, welcome to Humanize.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here with you.
If I were asked to describe Ben Carson in one word, I think I would say calm. How did you attain that virtue?
Well, I wasn't always calm. You know, as a youngster, I had a horrible temper, and I would just fly off the handle and try to hurt people. I didn't care what the consequences were. I just wanted to get even for whatever I perceived to be the problem. And one day, I almost stabbed someone. He had on a large metal belt buckle under his clothing, and a knife blade struck it with such force that it broke. And he fled in terror, but I was more terrified than he was because I realized I was trying to kill somebody. I had corrected my academic performance by that time. I was a straight-A student, but I knew I would never accomplish my goal of becoming a doctor with a temper like that. I just prayed that God would help me with it. And there was a Bible, and I picked it up and just opened it to the book of Proverbs. And there are all these verses about people who get angry, like Proverbs 19:19 that says there's no point getting an angry man out of trouble because he's just going to get right back into it. But also Proverbs 16:32 and verses like that, that said, mightier is the man who can control his temper than the man who can conquer a city. And as I thought and prayed and read, it came to me that the reason I was angry is because I was selfish. It was always about me, my, and I. somebody took my thing. They're in my space. I want this. They did this to me. And if I could step out of the center of the circle and let it be about other people, that it would have a profound effect. And in fact, it did. That was the last day I ever had an angry outburst.
How old were you when that happened?
14.
And yet you were able to kind of have that self-understanding that rage was leading you down bad paths and would destroy your ambitions to become a physician, and found the way out of that. That's quite remarkable.
Well, I attribute it not so much to me as I do to God. And I tell him, if he didn't fix it, I may as well just die, because it wasn't going to turn out well.
So you consider your calm, which I think you will acknowledge you is one of your attributes, as a gift from God?
No question about it. The understanding of it. And I strongly recommend to people who are listening, if you have a real anger problem, make yourself stop and just ask yourself, is this about me?
I'm going to remember that next time I decide to get angry at my wife. Because usually, you know what? It is about me. That's very good. You know, I'm impressed with your mother. She obviously had a difficult situation, a third grade education, as you put it. What is the most important lesson you learned from her?
Well, my mother was probably the person that I admire most in the world. She was born to a large family in rural Tennessee, bounced from house to house, never had a real place to call home, less than a third grade education, married at age 13, found that her husband was a bigamist, had to take care of her two sons by herself. And yet, the thing that you never heard from her was an excuse. She never felt sorry for herself. The problem was, she never felt sorry for us either. There was never an excuse that we could make that was acceptable. And I think that was perhaps the most important thing. She taught us not to make excuses.
Was she a strong disciplinarian, or was she just somebody who didn't accept any nonsense?
No, she was a very strong disciplinarian. You didn't cross her. It wasn't a good idea.
What about the racism of the time? I'm sure she must have faced that issue.
She did, but she never made much of it. She always told us, you know, people are people, and that's what you should believe. Even when we face some pretty horrendous episodes, like when I was in the eighth grade, by that time I had turned things around completely academically. I was horrible before that. I was a straight A student by that time. And they would have a special ceremony and certificate for the person with the highest grade point average. Well, that was me. Even though the band teacher had tried to ruin it by giving me a C, but found out the band didn't count. So I still got the award. And at the ceremony, one of the teachers got up and really bawled the white kids out, because I was the only black kid. And how can you let him be number one? It was ridiculous. My mother was unhappy.
I'll bet.
But all the other students, too, were kind of rolling their eyes and doing the, you know, crazy thing for that woman. But that's the way things were back in those days. That was back in the early 60s. And things changed, obviously. But a lot of people say that we're just as racist a country as ever. It's not true. You know, when I was 6 years old, I remember going to Chattanooga and seeing the whites only and colors only signs, and having people explain to you what that meant and what you could and couldn't do. And in that same lifetime, we have black admirals and generals and CEOs of Fortune 500 companies and heads of foundations and university presidents. We've had a president of the United States. To say that things are the same is absolutely absurd.
Astronaut.
And it's, yeah, right. And it shows our ability to make positive changes.
Yeah, I quite agree with you. You and I are of a similar age, and I remember, I'm a white guy, but I remember the racism of that era and the power of Martin Luther King's statement that we should be judged by the content of our character and not the color of our skins. And it seems to me that that's the approach you've taken throughout your career.
Absolutely. I personally don't spend a lot of time concerning myself with a person's external characteristics. Maybe that's because I'm a brain surgeon. When I peel back that scalp and I take off that bone flap and open the dura, I'm looking at the thing that makes that person who they are, the brain. It's not the skin or the hair or the shape of the nose. It's the brain. And you have to be pretty superficial just to think that those superficial things make a difference. And I always use the example of red ants and black ants. I said, what happens if you put red ants and black ants together? They fight. Why? Because one's red and one's black. I said, have you ever looked at an ant's brain? You can be looking for a long time. That's their excuse. What's our excuse?
You talked about in your biography, your love of reading. Where did that come from?
Well, it came from my mother. I didn't like reading. I liked television. And
me
I liked
too.
Playing yeah. like all the other kids. But I was doing so poorly in school. My brother was doing poorly in school. And my mother didn't know what to do. She worked as a domestic, two or three jobs at a time, leaving at 5 a.m, getting back at midnight. But she asked God to give her the wisdom. What could she do to get her young son to understand the importance of academic achievement? And he gave her the wisdom to look around at those beautiful homes that she cleaned. And what did she notice? Books. Lots of books. And she noticed that they didn't watch much television. So she came home and pronounced, you guys are going to start watching only two or three TV programs a week, and you got to read two books apiece from the Detroit Public Library and submit to me written book reports, which we thought was ridiculous. In today's world, we would have called social services, and they would have hauled away in cuffs, but we had to do it. And I didn't like it much at first, but after a while, I couldn't wait to get to those books. Because we were very poor. We didn't have money for anything. But between the covers of those books, I could go anywhere. I could be anybody. I could do anything. I just loved it. And I started reading about successful people. And I began to piece things together and realize that the person who has the most to do with what happens to you is you. It's not somebody else. Don't need to make any excuses. You just need to use the brain that God gave you. And from that point on, if I had 5 minutes, I was reading a book. I was always reading. And I went from being called the dummy to being called the bookworm. The same kids who used to call me dummy were coming to me saying, Benny, can you help me solve this problem? And I would say, sit at my feet, youngster, while I instruct you. I might have been a little obnoxious, but it sure felt good to suddenly be at the top instead of the bottom.
You know, that sense of achieving is really important in the human condition.
No question about it. You know, going to medical school, obviously you have to be a very good student. You have to be able to memorize a lot of material, and you have to be able to see how it goes together if you're going to be a good diagnostician.
You talk a lot about your faith. Did you grow up with faith because you were talking about your mother praying, or did the depth of your faith come later in life?
My mother always made sure we went to church and that we memorized the memory verses. We prayed together as a family. We read the Bible together, played our instruments together. Even though the environment might not have been the best, all you need is love in your family and togetherness. That gives you a tremendous advantage. And I have to give my mother so much credit because, you know, she also, whenever she saw a man who was very responsible and worked hard, she tried to make sure that she introduced him to us and that we had some time with him because she wanted us to have that influence in our lives. She realized the importance of having both a female and a male figure in your life. And I think that made a big difference also. And then when she saw men who were just terrible people, slobs and alcoholics, sitting on the corner with a brown bag, drinking from it like nobody knew what it was, she said, that's not the kind of person you want to be, neglecting your family, neglecting your children, and going nowhere in life. So she pointed out both kinds of people on a regular basis. And sometimes she would also take us to the beautiful homes that she cleaned. And she would say, see this beautiful place and see the place where we live. You get to choose which one you want.
Wow. Wow. Why did you decide on a medicine as a profession?
Well, medicine grabbed me as a child. I used to love to hear the mission stories, particularly about missionary doctors and how they travel all over the world. Great personal danger sometimes to bring not only physical, but mental and spiritual healing to people. And they seemed to me like the most noble people on the face of the earth. So I decided when I was 8 years old that I was going to be a missionary doctor. Now, things changed over the course of time. Then I wanted to be a psychiatrist. And, you know, that might have been occasioned by the fact that my mother had some psychiatric issues, great depression, particularly after she found out that she was married to a bigamist. And a lot of times people who go into psychiatry do so for personal reasons.
Now, that's interesting.
They also have the highest suicide rate of any group of professionals. And that's probably because they do have some psychological issues and they find out that they can't solve them. But then I started, when I got to medical school, listening to the neurosurgeons and the things they could do. And I was just blown away. I was completely taken in by it. And a lot of people were saying, no, not neurosurgery. At that time, there had been 8 black neurosurgeons in the world. But the good Lord does not distribute talent based on race.
Yes.
I just was magnetized to neurosurgery, took to it like a duck takes to water. And it seemed like the place for me. And it obviously turned out that it was.
You know, brain surgery, which is what we're talking about here, requires tremendous responsibility and skill. But it's also very fraught. I mean, you are really dealing with life and death every time you open up a skull, aren't you?
No question about it. And it's probably the reasons that neurosurgeons tend to die a little earlier than everybody else from all the stress. I didn't realize how stressful it was until I stopped doing it.
That's interesting.
All of a sudden I said, you mean there's nobody dying? It was very different.
When you started this work, and you said earlier that, you know, the brain is where we are, where we can be found. Did you have any first time or even later on when you were looking at open brains, did that impact your view of humanity at all?
Well, you know, I never lost my awe of the human brain. Every time I opened somebody's skull and cut that dura open, I would say, wow, that is what makes this person who they are. And, you know, in terms of humanity, you know, there are a lot of animals who also have brains with frontal lobes and parietal lobes and occipital lobes and temporal lobes and brain stems and cerebellum and look similar to ours, although we have by far the largest frontal lobes. There is something that is not tangible that provides the basis of humanity, our spirituality, our spiritual selves, how we communicate with God. And there's something about human beings that is very different from any other living organism for that reason.
I've had on the program some people who were involved in neurosurgery and so forth that describe a difference between the mind and the brain. And they believe that those two are not synonyms. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. You can't touch the mind, but you can affect it. Your mind is affected when you fall in love.
Yes.
Your mind is affected when you fill it with hatred. And think about people who hate and don't forgive and how that causes physiological impact. Think about this. If a tiger walked into the room where you are right now and didn't touch you, you just saw him, what would happen?
I'd be really scared.
Your blood pressure would go up. Your pulse rate would go up. Your eye pupils would dilate. Things would happen to your bladder. All kinds of things would happen. And he never touched you. Now, can you imagine if you have chronic anxiety, what that potentially does to your body?
Yeah, and it leads to things like stroke, I guess, and heart conditions and so forth.
All kinds of things.
You wrote about your experiences as a surgeon in a book entitled Gifted Hands. What did writing, because I think that's your first book, correct?
Yes.
What did writing teach you about reading, and what did reading teach you about writing?
Well, I think it taught me, both taught me the incredible impact of words. Now, I was reading a letter just yesterday from a young man who had a very difficult time growing up, was put into special education, just wasn't making any progress. And one day in his special ed class, he was looking at the bookshelf and he said, you know, those books are just there. Nobody ever reads them. But he's running his fingers over them and he came across Gifted Hands and he started reading it. He said he couldn't put it down and it completely changed his life. He went from being a special ed, unaccomplished student to a very good student, realizing that it was within his own power to do that. And so many people have told me stories like that. And I never wanted to write a book. After the operation on the first set of craniopagus twins, people kept saying to me, you should write a book. I said, I don't want to write a book. After about the 10th publisher came to me and said, you should write a book. I said, okay, I'll write a book. And it was interesting because they said autobiographies, it would be really good if you sell 10 to 15,000 books. That would be a real blockbuster. It sold over 2 million.
Really?
Absolutely.
I'm an author, so I hate you now.
But, you know, the Lord, when the Lord has a purpose in it, it's not something that you can control one way.
It really is a very easy read. I was looking at it and I have it on my desk here and it really, the case histories are quite fascinating. And you brought up one of them, which are the conjoined twins. So you were able to, and I think you made world news by separating conjoined twins that were connected literally in the brain, correct? Tell us about that story and how you were able to manage to separate them and let them both thrive thereafter.
Well, first of all, I got really interested in conjoined twins and craniopagus twins joined at the head. And I started reading all about them and studying them. And then I said, why am I studying all this stuff? I'm never going to see a set of craniopagus twins. And about 3 weeks later, there they were. And I was really asking myself, why are the outcomes so bad? Why do so many of them die? And the reason was they would bleed to death. And I started saying, there must be a way. That was 1987, which seems like ancient times now, but that was the before times. Modern times here. Why can't we figure out a way to keep them from bleeding to death? And I was talking to a friend of mine, the chief of cardiothoracic surgery at Hopkins. And I say, you guys operate sometimes on little babies' hearts. How do you keep them from bleeding out? And he told me about hypothermic arrest, which you cool the body temperature till the heart stops, pump all the blood out, and you got up to an hour in an infant before you have to restore the blood flow. And I was thinking, in that hour, we could get through the most complex joining of vessels and then reconstruct the vessels before we had to put the blood back in and start the heart up. And I explained that to many of my colleagues at Hopkins and everybody said, you know, that sounds like it could possibly work. And we kind of put our heads together and started thinking about all the pros and cons and what would need to be done and concluded that this was in fact a very doable thing.
Let me get this straight. It's almost like they're in hibernation or even that they are dead, except it's not irreversible.
That's right. Their hearts are not beating, but there is liquid flowing through their, vessel keeping everything patent.
And is that done mechanically?
Yes.
Okay.
The anesthesiologist and the cardio technicians take care of all that. And they do that routinely. So this was just using a technique that already existed to help solve a problem that had not been solvable previously.
And what did the parents or the mother or father of the twins say when you made the suggestion of trying this novel approach?
Well, they knew that if they weren't separated, their lives would be very short and very miserable.
Yeah.
So they understood, obviously, that it was a tremendous risk. And, you know, it was very much looked at in the news media throughout the world. It was, you know, Time and Newsweek said this was the most complex surgery ever done. So there was a lot of attention to it.
How long did it take, and were you able to do the blood vessels within that time period?
It took 22 hours, and the hypothermic arrest time, the 1 hour, we finished in 59 minutes and some seconds. And we tell everybody, don't tell us how much time we have left, because that just increases the pressure.
Yeah.
We'll go as fast as we can, and hopefully we can get it done.
So I want to get into your being as you're approaching this incredible responsibility. I said at the beginning of this interview that I thought one of your great attributes is calm. Did you find yourself in that sense of calm that we discussed earlier?
Absolutely. You just keep everything in perspective. And for me, I always pray. I always pray before the case, during the case, after the case, asking God for guidance, and he never fails.
So in the once the separation was successful, how did the twins do?
Initially, they were doing pretty well, and then they developed meningitis serratia, which is almost uniformly fatal.
Is that a virus?
That's a bacteria.
Bacteria.
And because their scalps couldn't be completely closed, the scalp had shrunken down operation, and the plastic surgeons had to do all kinds of things to try to maintain the integrity of the intracranial space. But unfortunately, they both got that. And then one of them aspirated fluid into their lungs, and that really damaged them both. But they survived for many years after that.
And you said you did a couple of other sets of twins?
Yeah, there was the ones that were the most successful were what we call type 2 vertical craniopagus. They join at the top of the head facing in opposite directions. They were from Zambia, and that operation took 28 hours. It was very difficult and very involved. But after that operation finished, the people were literally dancing in the streets. I mean, this was done in their country at their hospital. They were just unbelievably thrilled. And those young men now, completely intact neurologically.
Are you in touch with them at all?
It's been several years since we've been in contact with them.
Well, that's just a remarkable story to be able to basically save these, not only save their lives, but to give them a life.
And, you know, to contribute to the techniques. You know, there are still occasional operations these days to separate twins, but there's been so many advancements, and that was part of it. That's why you don't hear about them anymore.
So in terms of medicine and science, it's all a matter of incremental improvements, right? And that's what this was.
And, you know, just think about the turn of the century, not this one to 2000, but the turn of the century before that. Average life expectancy was 57 years, and now it's close to 80 years because of things that have been done in medicine that make a huge difference in our lives. And now, today, we have the MAHA movement,
yes,
which is helping us, again, to be able to extend our lives and the quality of our lives.
You left medicine at some point, and I want to get into your post-medical career. But what did practicing medicine teach you, if anything, about the human condition?
Well, it teaches you that all of us are more than just flesh and blood. The human condition is much more complex than just flesh and blood. Why is it that some people who really don't have much use of their body can still intellectualize? It tells you how incredible the mind is, an active mind, in terms of what it can potentially do, and why we must always take the whole being in consideration, not just the liver, just the brain, not just the heart. The whole thing, including the brain and including the intangible aspects of a person and why that is important. And, in terms of what the mind can actually do in terms of health, I remember there was a young man, he was a basketball player from New York, and he had a glioblastoma, which is a very malignant brain tumor.
My sister-in-law died of that, yes.
Yeah, so people don't live with those. But he was doing great for years, and we said, wow, what is going on with this guy? And then his fiance broke up with him, and he was very depressed, and he was dead in 3 weeks.
That's really something.
Yeah.
How long did you practice medicine, neurosurgery?
Well, I finished my residency in 83, and I practiced until 13.
So let's say 20 years. And what made you decide to leave?
Well, someone had told me that neurosurgeons tend to die early, and I didn't believe it. So I wrote down the names and times of death of the last 10 neurosurgeons that I knew who died. An average death was at age 61.
That's young.
So I decided on my own that I would retire if I was still alive when I was 61.
So you had basically planned that. And as you were approaching the time when you knew you were going to retire, what were you thinking about in terms of your next stage of your life?
I was thinking I would learn to play the organ. I've always loved particularly Bach organ music, and I would become a very good golfer and just enjoy the rest of my life. That's what I thought.
And what actually happened? Did you become a good golfer?
No.
Neither did I. Did you learn to play the organ?
I did not, because I failed retirement completely. In 2013, which was the year that I stopped practicing, I was asked to give the keynote address at the Presidential Prayer Breakfast, which really surprised me because I had given the keynote at the Presidential Prayer Breakfast in 1997 when Bill Clinton was president. And I didn't know anybody ever did it twice. But some research showed me that there was one person who did it twice, and that was Billy Graham. I said, that's pretty good company. So I agreed to do it, but I didn't know what I was going to talk about. And they kept asking, what are you going to speak about? What are you going to speak? Because President Obama has to respond. And I said, I don't know. I'll let you know as soon as I know. I didn't know until the morning of the prayer breakfast. And after that speech, everybody was saying, you should run for president. And I said, these people are crazy. I said, if I just ignore them, they'll go away. But it never went away. Every place I went, they had placards, run, Ben, run. I had over 500,000 petitions in my office. And I finally just said, Lord, I don't want to run for president. But if you want me to, you have to give me all the things that a presidential candidate has, a Rolodex with all the important names, an organization, and a lot of money. All of a sudden, all of those things were there. Our organization was raising more money per month than the RNC. And, I got to travel all over the country. And one of the things that was really encouraging during all that travel, from the smallest hamlets in North Dakota and Alabama to the largest cities is the fact that most of the American people have common sense. And that's very encouraging. What they lack is courage. People, for the most part, are not willing to stand up for what they believe. They'd rather stand in the corner and look at their toes than to get involved in a controversy. And that's how particularly left-wing organizations and individuals have gotten so far ahead, because they have no qualms about taking the microphone and blasting out what they want to put out.
I also think that the reason why many of these progressive or woke policies advance is people don't think it's serious, but they do. And my theory is the side with the most energy tends to win. And so when you have one side that really believes in these issues and pushes them hard, and another side that says, oh, no, they'll never do that, right, you end up with predictable results.
Yeah, I think that's a large part of it. And, you know, sadly, the things that are happening in our country now are planned. You know, if you go back and look at the congressional record, January the 10th, 1963, it was Congressman Herlong of Florida who read into the record 45 goals of communism in America over 60 years ago. And there were such things as gaining control of the school systems and the teacher union so you could indoctrinate the kids from an early age, gaining control of the media and Hollywood so you could change the core values of the American people, denigrating the role of fathers and families, ridiculing the church, making sexual perversion normal, natural, and healthy. I mean, all the things that are happening today are planned because they knew that they couldn't overcome our country militarily, so you destroy it from within. The family, the faith, the important elements that made us into a great nation.
You brought, as I recall, as a follower of the news, those sensibilities and those thoughts into your work as Secretary of Health of Housing and Urban Development. What did you see during those years of service that impacted you the most?
I think the fact that when I went there, I thought this was going to be a slam dunk. I said, because everybody wants to get people out of poverty and get them into a better living situation. So there should be bipartisan support. Not true. There are a lot of people who derive their power from representing people who are indigent. They don't want to see those people become successful.
Because it would dry up their funding?
That really surprised me. I was also surprised at how deep the corruption was. And when I got there, there had not been a federal audit of HUD for several years. It's required every year, but you couldn't do a federal audit because there were so many material defects. So job number one was to be able to get a really good person. We got one of the senior managers from Ernst & Young to come over. It took a lot of arm twisting. And when he first came, he said, Ernst & Young would have never taken you on as a client. But he put together a team and they really got things straightened out. And you might have noticed about a year and a half into the first Trump administration, you stopped hearing all those horrible stories about HUD and fiscal mismanagement. It was because of that. Once we got that out of the way, we were able to get a lot of other things accomplished.
What do you think is the greatest accomplishment during your tenure?
Our greatest accomplishment would be getting the finances straightened out so that you actually knew what was going on so that you could promote the other programs. Programs like FYI, Foster Youth to Independence. There are about 20,000 young people who age out of foster care each year, and about a quarter to a third of them ended up homeless. Another large percentage of them ended up in situations worse than homeless. And some of the students came and they explained their situation to us. And everybody was really motivated to do something about this. And in less than 4 months, we had the FYI program functional, where people aging out of foster care could not only get an apartment to live in, but wraparound services, because you're 18 and you don't have any other support. Even if you have an apartment, you may not do too well. And get that, very gratifying. There are lots of other programs that I really enjoy, like the mustard seed program. Faith's the size of a mustard seed.
Yes.
We would say, look at churches and faith-based organizations that are doing a good job with homeless people. And instead of making them jump through 1,000 hoops for federal support, we say, if you're doing a really good job, we'll support what you're doing and help expand it. And it was great to see some of those programs get whole families back on their feet and moving in the right direction. But, you know, recognizing that government can work with the faith community. And in fact, before government got so big and involved, it was the faith community that took care of all these issues.
Your time in office was a time of increasing governmental dysfunction, it seems to me, societal division, and so forth. What do you attribute that to?
Evil. As simply put, you know, the Bible tells us that it will get worse and worse. And you know, what are we seeing today? Just complete irrational thinking taking over. When suddenly people think men can have babies, they can think that it's all right to tell children's brains are not fully developed to make incredible decisions about their body, which cannot be reversed. They think we shouldn't have borders, and that anybody should be able to come into your country, and that you shouldn't need to have voter ID, that anybody can vote. You know, that's like somebody comes into a neighborhood where they're having a debate about whether they should build a pool, and this person doesn't live there, is not part of the community, and says, I should be able to vote on that too. That doesn't make any sense. There are a whole bunch of things that really have been done without thinking about the consequences.
A lot of people talk about our culture wars, and some say that the reason there's a culture war is that there is an attempt to radically change the culture, and then people saying, no, I don't want to radically change the culture, or the culture warriors. What do you think about that assertion?
Well, I think, again, there are a lot of people who don't think, and they don't realize that they're being manipulated. One of the things about Marxism is they always come in and they dumb down the population. They try to take away your history or change your history. And you can see the effects of that. You might have seen some of these man on the street interviews when they ask people simple questions. Who was the first president of the United States? You know, what's the significance of the 4th of July? Just stuff. They have no idea what you're talking about. Those kinds of individuals are very easy to manipulate. And then they change your history also. You know, the United States of America has an incredible history if you go back and look at the whole thing, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But those who want to fundamentally change us, they just take the ugly, the bad and the ugly. And they try to make people think that because we had slavery, we're evil.
We're forever.
Uniquely evil.
Yeah.
You know, we have to correct all of these things that are not right, and we have to talk about them and educate people. We have a very proud history, but if you can get the young people thinking that we're actually an evil country, we stole land from the Indians, you know, we mistreated people, and if that's all they hear, it's really hard for those people to be patriotic. And that makes it a whole lot easier to flip things around. And that's what's in the process of happening right now in our country.
Yeah, I have kind of reached a conclusion that people are being taught to feel instead of think. And so, and those are not the same things at all. No. So you'll hear people say, I feel this or I feel that. Well, if what you feel today and you think is right based on those feelings today, you may feel differently tomorrow. And then that becomes a, like the house built on sand, that there's no firm foundation for principles or for actions.
That's exactly right. But there is some good that's going on. Like young men and Gen Z are returning to the church in large numbers. And I think they've been around long enough to see the direction that we're going in, and they don't like where it leads. So they're saying there must be a better way. And that's very encouraging to see that happening.
Yet at the same time, it appears that young women are going in the opposite direction. Why do you think that might be?
I think the young women are thinking about their careers versus their family, and they can't do both, and that's not fair, which is why the birth rate is so low. But I think that will get better. And the reason I think that is because of some of the advantages of AI will make it very easy for them to have a career at home, still advance and still be able to socialize with people at work, gain from their knowledge of mistake and triumphs, and still be able to be at home raising their family. And once they discover that, I think a lot of that animosity will disappear.
Well, that brings us to your book, The Perilous Fight, Overcoming Our Culture War in the American Family. Who do you think is waging that war, and what are the battlefields, and what is the goal?
Well, family is the fundamental building block of a strong society. Families make communities, and communities make nations. And if you want to fundamentally change a nation, that's where you start, destroying that strong family foundation. And every place that has happened, they've had very significant problems. And we were very fortunate to have the kind of values and principles that our founding fathers gave us. Our Declaration of Independence tells us that our rights come from our Creator. We start there. We talk about liberty and justice for all. It took us a while to get there, but you have to have those guiding principles in order to become the kind of nation that is strong. And you look at the foundations for us, our faith was crucial to the development of our country. And then the concept of liberty, freedom in this country is known across the globe. Everybody knows about the American dream. Do you know of any other dream of any other nation? I don't think anybody.
That's else. Right. You don't think of the Chinese dream or the Pakistani dream.
And then you have the sense of community, which was so powerful. You think about early America, and you would have a settlement, 50 or 100 families from different places. They didn't even speak the same language, but they understood one important concept. It's called the common good. It's a phrase you heard frequently from our founding fathers. And if Mr. Jones broke his leg at harvest time, guess what? Everybody else harvested his crops. They didn't ask him what his religion was. They didn't ask him what his politics were. They knew he was their neighbor and he needed help. You know, that sense of community was very strong. And there are forces that are trying to destroy that sense of community and make us think that we're all enemies if we don't agree with each other. And that's a real problem for us, that we must work hard and we must resolve that problem. And then the love and respect for life from the womb to the tomb. And those pillars, those foundational pillars, gave us great strength.
And you used the term we when referring to the book. I assume you were talking about your wife, Candy, and your family. What has your family meant to you in terms of the successes you've had?
It's foundational. I couldn't do it without my wife, to whom I've been married for almost 51 years now. And she really carried a heavy load, because as the director of pediatric neurosurgery, I had an incredibly busy schedule. And she had to do most of the raising of our sons herself. She did a marvelous job. You know, I was operating all the time or traveling a lot, giving a lot of talks. And I made it a condition for my travel that my whole family come with me. So all the kids had frequent flyer cards for every airline. And my mother would go with us too. There were the six of us traveling all over the place. And that way my kids wouldn't grow up saying, "Hey, Mommy, that strange guy was here again last night." I didn't want that to happen.
Yeah. That, you know, the importance of fathers. I think we lost that track for a while. My dad, who died way too young, but he's still, many years after he's gone, fundamental to who I am as a human being and as a man. So it's really very important. In the book, you write about three steps that American teens can take to avoid poverty. What are those steps and why did you include those particular three?
Well, there's actually been studies done by institutions like the Brookings Institute that if you finish high school, get a job, get married, and wait until you're married to have children, then your chances of living in poverty are 2% or less. So that used to be known. And now it's, what?
Yeah.
And we have to get back to it being known again.
And followed,
exactly.
Yeah. I'm interested that you said your mother traveled with you. That is she still with us or has she passed on?
No, she passed on in 2017. But I'll tell you, it was one of the joys of my life to make sure that my mother lived in comfort. Always had a new car, got to travel with us all over the world. Had a fantastic wardrobe, which would rival a princess.
I was going to ask you, what did she think? I mean, she must have been bursting at the seams with pride at your achievements.
Well, people would always ask her, "I bet you're really proud of your son." And she would say, "Yes, I am. And I'm proud of Benjamin too."
Yeah.
Because my brother became a rocket scientist.
Really?
So she had a brain surgeon and a rocket scientist.
Those are two of the most cerebral positions that you can get. My goodness. Well, good for, you know, she's obviously the hero of the story of you and your brother.
No question about it. And, you know, she was on the front of Parade magazine on Mother's Day.
Wow.
She couldn't read growing up, but she did eventually teach herself to read, got her GED, went to college. And in 1994, she was awarded an honorary doctorate. So she was Dr. Carson too.
Wow, that's just terrific. What is the purpose after you left government? You formed the American Cornerstone Institute. What is the purpose of the institute and why did you feel the need to pursue that?
Well, you know, when I retired from the first Trump administration, as I said before, I was going to play the organ and play golf and enjoy life. But seeing the direction of the country, I said, I wouldn't have any fun cruising around the world and playing golf with the country going down the tubes. So myself and some very talented individuals from HUD got together and say, we have to form a think tank to help move people in the right direction. And then we started doing things also. So we call it a think tank do think. Don't just think about it.
Do things. Yeah.
But, you know, the whole purpose of it is to help to direct our country back toward the principles of our founding and our rise. And that goes back to those four pillars that I talked about, our faith, liberty, community, and life. And then we have a little Patriots program, which has grown tremendously, in which we try to make sure that our young people from K through 5 actually know who we are, actually know what our history is. You can go to Star Spangled Adventures on YouTube, and you have vignettes there about various people and events that helped to make this country what it was. And we actually have a feature length movie coming out called Star Spangled Adventures, the movie.
Wow.
It'll be premiering on June the 14th of this year at the Trump Kennedy Center.
Congratulations on that. And for listeners, we will have links to those sources in the program notes. I want to get back a little bit to medical school. I do a lot of writing in bioethics and so forth, and I've noticed that medical schools seem to be imposing DEI policies, both in who they accept as students and what they teach. What do you think of that?
Well, I think you'll see that the DEI policies are starting to disappear from medical schools because they realize that it isn't something that really works.
Yeah.
You know, if you got people who are doing things that impact your life, that's not a time for DEI. That's a time for excellence.
Yes.
And what we must do is make sure that the students are prepared at a much earlier time in their lives so that you don't have to, well, that's not important that they know that or that they can do. That's not the way that we do things here in America. You certainly don't want somebody flying an airplane that you're on who may not be the best person to do it. And by having people achieve based on who they are, and not on some physical appearance, you're going to do much better. And throughout my medical career, I've seen plenty of individuals who look like myself who are superb. I graduated from the University of Michigan Medical School. The year after I graduated, the top student, Alexa Kennedy, was black. And a couple of years after her, Keith Black was black. Both of them became neurosurgeons, but, you know, it's not unusual to have people of color to be excellent in what they do. So that's what we need to concentrate on, making sure that the pool of candidates is highly qualified and particularly getting to people early on, because that's where the foundation for academic excellence is laid down.
We're almost out of time, but I do want to ask you about the Carson Scholars Fund. What is the purpose of the fund, and how can people help if they're interested?
Well, about 30 years or so ago, I was going into a lot of schools to talk to the children all over the country. And the first thing you would see when you walked into the school was what? The trophy display. All state this, all state that, all state the other. But not much in terms of academic achievement. And we said, we really need to do something about that. So we started that program to recognize young people with superior academic performance. You have to have at least a 3.75 GPA and a 4.0 scale to even be considered. And you have to demonstrate significant humanitarian qualities that you care about other people. Because the purpose of the program is to develop future leaders who are not only smart. I mean, Hitler was smart. Marquis de Sade was smart, but they didn't care about people. And if you can it's been demonstrated that if you can get young people interested in philanthropic endeavors, they tend to maintain that throughout their lives. So that's the real purpose of it. And so many teachers have told us when we put a Carson Scholar in their class, the GPA of the whole class goes up because all of a sudden, wow, it's because of that person that beautiful trophy is out in the trophy display. And they become very proud of them. And some schools had more than one scholar. And we also put in reading rooms all over the country. I think we're up to about 310 now. And they have places that little kids come in and they absolutely love the book selection. They get points for the number of books they read. They can trade them in for prizes. That's what they want in the beginning. But after a while, they actually start learning to love reading and what a difference that makes in their academic performance.
Boy, it's interesting how your life has had some through lines from your mother's teaching to your deciding to love reading and how that has actually affected you throughout the course of your life.
No question about it. She asked God for wisdom and he gave it to her.
Well, we're out of time and I've really enjoyed our conversation and I've always appreciated your work, both when you were a doctor and I'd read about you in the magazines and in your subsequent public service. What next for Dr. Ben Carson?
Only the Lord knows. But, I'll be 75 on my next birthday. Every day is a bonus at this stage.
I feel your pain. Well, thank you, Dr. Carson. I really appreciate it.
All right. And thank you for being a patriot.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.